Hey everybody, I'm recording the intro today on my phone to just give you get you kind of used to the audio quality that's going to take place in this episode. We have a legendary comedian with us today. His name is Daryl Lennox, and he's absolutely fantastic, full of knowledge, full of insight about the business. It's got a little different pace to it this episode because we do talk about some serious things, a little more serious than normal. But also just a fantastic time listening to Daryl. Daryl has been losing his vision for quite a while, and it officially is gone. He's 100% blind now. So he called in, and then of course my card that I normally record on was full, and so I'm recording in the Zoom room today. A lot of things going on, but if you're able to really focus and listen, you're going to get a ton of insight on comedy and just get to listen to one of the coolest guys in the business. I mean, it really is incredible what he's done. So I hope you guys enjoy the episode. I know you're going to, and can't wait to get you guys back next week. All right. Enjoy. Hey everybody, this is Chad Daniels, and you have landed in the middle of somewhere. Hello, thank you for joining us. This is wonderful. We have a fantastic show today. Across from me, as always, Cyrus Amundson.
Hi, buddy. It's nice to be here. I managed to finish my food before the show started.
That's what you think, because you can't see your mustache. There's still some food in there.
My goal was to not have to deal with that indignant fucking look on your face, because I needed, my time zones are different and I don't like to shift my lunch for our show. So I raced through it so I didn't have to deal with your judgmental eyeballs, and I'm here now.
You looked like a 5-year-old eating powdered donuts or a 25-year-old in the early 80s. You just had white powder, whatever that was, all over your mustache.
Oh, I thought you were saying just how a child can't help but, like, mash food into their face at an aggressive rate when it's something they want.
Also that. Yeah. I like to write my jokes in layers.
Sure. I had real, it was a real wood chipper mouth situation with these breakfast tacos.
I am going to stop talking to you because I am so excited for our guest today. We have I don't even know how to get into this. I mean, we're dealing with a comedy legend, and I just had the privilege of getting to hang out with him the night before Thanksgiving at the Kevin Bozeman pre-Thanksgiving show in Madison. And if you want an encyclopedia of comedic knowledge, if you, you know, I've been doing this for 23 years, and this gentleman sat me down and was like, have you ever thought of this? And I was like, what? I mean, just the insight is absolutely incredible. So I'm just going to bring him on right now. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Daryl Lennox.
Hey, thank you, Chad and Cyrus. It's good to be here with both of you guys. That's pretty nice thing you said about me, man. I appreciate it. But obviously, I love your game, so always a pleasure to be around you.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. And I'm going to tell the story that I told in Madison. So I was trying to get into a club. Did you start comedy in Canada? You did, right?
No, I started Seattle Comedy Underground.
Oh, well, that's pretty close to Canada. So I'm going to take that as a half point credit.
Okay.
A club that's been both the worst and best club in America at some point in this last 40 years.
Absolutely. Could not have been more well said than that.
But, you know, the reason I thought you started in Canada is because when I go to Canada, like when you tour the clubs in America, there's always an oversized, there's pictures of comedians everywhere, but there's always an oversized picture of, let's say, Robin Williams, or, you know, Eddie Murphy, or just like, and then I go to Canada and your picture is the one that's oversized. I mean, you go to Winnipeg and you tell people, you know, Daryl Lennox, and it's like, they'll carry you out of the room without even having you say another word. And that's what brings me to this story. is I was in Vancouver and we're going to this nightclub and this line was so long. So I walked to the front of the line with some of the staff and I was peering in and the bouncer goes, "Can I help you?" And I was like, "Oh, my friend Daryl Lennox is in there. And he told us just to head to the front of the line." And you were not in there, by the way. And then he goes, "You know Daryl?" And we were like, "Yeah." And then he let us in. So I've been using your name for shit forever. I feel like this is that Justin Bieber song where I'm the girlfriend that uses your name for stuff.
Now, why in the world do you think I would know a fucking Justin Bieber song, Chad Daniels?
I have no idea.
Yeah, Canada's been an incredible place for me, man. So I started in Seattle, and then about 5 years later, I just destroyed my career. And then ran into LA, got married too fast and destroyed that too. So I had no place to go. I had 1 week of work up in Vancouver. And then, I was booked as a headliner and then they fired me midweek and dropped me down the middle, at the end. At the end of the week, the club owner goes, "So where are you going to go now?" I said, "I have no idea, man. I got no place to go. I'm homeless." And he goes, "Stay here to kind of figure things out." And so I stayed there and I did a big reinvention of myself. You know, instead of trying to be famous and try to chase stardom, I just wanted to fall in love with being a great comic. And so that's where I started doing it, in just Canada. So I stayed there basically from 1994 until they kicked me out in 2005. And so I did a lot of work during that time.
That's incredible. I have so many questions just based on that story. You said you ruined your career. What happened?
Yes. So I was, I'm a big, one of those big goofy manifest destiny guys, sure. The think and grow rich kind of guys. But because I grew up kind of janky, I would try to shortcut it. So what I did was,
you tried to shortcut manifest destiny.
Yeah, I tried to shortcut it. So this is, you know, 92 somewhere when Mark Curry was the hottest comic in the game. And, you know, it was very popular to be a black comic back then. So everybody was getting TV shows and I was just a smart guy with not a lot of talent. And so, I got to hang out in LA and I met this guy who was a big agent from William Morris named Rick Greenstein.
Okay.
So I met him and so what I did was I went back to Seattle and I told everybody that Rick Greenstein had signed me from the William Morris agency. And so then Seattle being a small town, next thing you know, I'm getting calls from the newspaper and they bought me up the headline. So I started riding with it. the level of girls I was getting changed drastically. And so I was really faking it till I make it. I just kept pushing the narrative. And then at some point it all came to a head when, I told everybody I was going to be in Arsenio Hall on March the 15th, the Ides of March, like an idiot. and then I flew to LA, and just stayed in an apartment with Carl Banks and Troy Third Deal, two local comics from the Northwest, and watched myself not appear on Arsenio, bro. And so then, then the backlash hit. You know, everybody was like, "Oh!" And then two comics turned, you know, went to the press and told them that I had made up all this stuff, and there's a big article. Daryl Lennox is a comedic fraud, and so I was persona non grata in Seattle, LA, everything. It was just a mess, dude. And so I went to Vancouver, and then I called everybody that I had ever dicked around and apologized and sent back. I was paying back women $20 Canadian a week because that's how little I was getting paid to cancel my debts. So I really had to just really kind of do a whole clean myself out and start all over. And so that's what happened, bro.
It's two things. One, that's a real, people don't usually have that self-realization when they've been acting like a piece of shit. They normally just, like, nobody really lives out "my name is Earl," where they just apologize and try to right all their wrongs because they got caught. So that's pretty good on you. But also, I kind of long for the days where you could carry out a lie like that for months and months. Like now, what would a comedian pull that off for 4 days with Twitter? Like, I kind of miss those days where you could just lie about who you were for half a year.
Everybody's sex game was way much better pre-Google. We could just make up anything pre-Google, right?
Yeah, that's very true.
You could be anything. I was there on the grassy knoll. I saw it. Wait a minute, you're only 20.
Yeah, I had a little bit of that too in my life where, a while back I stopped lying completely, even white lies, and I had to call some friends and sit them down. So I traveled to see them so I could sit them down and talk to them about, I don't know why my throat sounds like I'm underwater right now, but there we go. Got
Guys, he's starting to cry. Don't let him lie to you. He's emoting.
it. And then another thing. But yeah, so and it's not easy to make those calls and have those conversations at all, So
No. But
that's
some people understand, other people go, well, you deserve it. Fuck you.
yeah.
Yeah, and that's a tough pill to swallow, but you have to. You have no
Yeah.
choice.
Yeah. So that's how I messed everything up.
Okay. Well, I mean, obviously, there's been some grace because you're back at it, killing it, of course. And so I'm going to talk about this later, but you have a new album. You have a new album coming out, and only person ever to have a comedy special on Stars, which is I don't even know how someone does that, but. So you said you were in Canada from 1994 to 2005 when they kicked you out. Why'd they kick you out?
So right around 98, 99, they changed the liquor laws. You used to have a permit. The club would send you a work permit application. You take that to the border, you pay $125, and they let you in. Then they changed the liquor law so comedy clubs didn't have to issue work permits. And so, but nobody knew how to do it. So they just said, just come up here. But I already had an apartment up there. So I was going up there for years and doing the festivals. And, even though I had an apartment there, I would have to literally get a ride from Vancouver all the way down to Bellingham and circle the flagpole, come back.
Okay.
Well, because, I'm such a goofy idiot dude and play too intense about things. A couple of girls got mad at me. And so one of them knew that my biggest fear at that time was from the movie Casino. Remember when the stupid kid, his uncle came into De Niro's office and said, was there a place along the trough you can? De
Yeah.
Niro goes, nope, he's too stupid.
Is there a place you can just place him? Yeah.
So then the cowboy guy says, when are you guys gonna learn? You're not from here, you're just renting this place and we're gonna have to kick the kike out of here. And that was always been my biggest fear, that because I've lived so nomadic, all somebody could ever do is I'm gonna have to kick this dude out of here. So like a dummy, I told this girl that I was she found I was cheating on her, so she called immigration. So on August 19th, 2005, I'm newly in love with Claire, who became my wife. I fly from Tampa to come back to Canada to do a gig, and they froze me up and said, we think you're living here illegally. And I was like, no, I'm not. And then so they put me in there. They said, we're going to put you in jail. I said, okay, I am living here. But I told them everything. I told them everything. They said, well, because you're misrepresented, you're banned from the country for a year. I go, what about my apartment and my stuff, everything? They said, you have to figure that out, but you're not allowed here for a year. If you try to come back in, it's a permanent ban. So they spun me around, and all I had was a duffel bag once again. And so I had to figure out where I was going to go. And so they kicked me out, and eventually, after the year was up, then he's ram it through the ringer all the time. But finally, now, I'm really, they've accepted me what back and incredibly so much so now. So,
Oh, that's great. I can't believe as an adult, you've had two redos, because I know where you are now. I know where you are now, so I guess it surprises me that you've had to start over with a duffel bag twice.
Yeah.
Because
Well,
I don't see myself coming. I mean, that's like tailspin worthy for me. I would lose my shit probably and just, end up in jail for free food or a mental institution. And I'm not mocking the mental institution. I'm saying I think I might.
you know what? I don't know how you guys feel about, your own expectations. We all try to do that. We gauge ourselves. But for me, I didn't want everybody that said I was a piece of shit to be right. And so if I would have let either one of those duffel bag incidences, in my journey there, they would have been right. So I believe what I'm capable of is a lot, which, made me take a lot of insane, dumb risks. But I've always believed that I'm capable of something extraordinary. And so I just can't. That's part of the journey, I guess. Getting homeless a couple times. Well, if that's what it takes to be extraordinary, then that's what I'm gonna do. And so I would never advise anybody to do it like that. But that's just what I've done.
I see similarities in that too. I mean, I think that's, part of the reason, you get divorced and you think, well, everybody has this vision of you, and if you don't like the vision, it's up to you to change their mind. And so I've also had to deal with that, but twice. I mean, I'm just picturing you at the border with a duffel bag. That's absolutely mind-blowing.
It was too.
So you're calling in today. Normally we have people in the Zoom room. You're calling in because you cannot see.
Not anymore.
Yeah, you so you so when I met you, you had a little bit of vision. And then the first time we talked, you said, "Yeah, it's slowly closing, slowly closing." And then when I saw you in Madison, you're completely blind now, right?
So the left eye, I've always been born with really bad eyes, just really super myopic, degenerative eyes. And the left eye, during that first duffel bag trip to Canada, I got into a fight, because my ex-wife, told me that, she had just had sex with Charles Barkley and James Worthy. And I'm a loser sleeping in a bunk bed in Canada. And so that just infuriated me.
Can I weigh in here?
Please do.
That your wife sounds really cool. That sounds like something I would have said. Absolutely. She's good because
Well,
you this your ex or your
okay.
girlfriend. This sounds, I mean, this is like the height of Charles Barkley too. Like he's just retired going
Yeah,
into the Hall of Fame.
90.
He's about to be a
This.
superstar on TNT. Yeah, if you're gonna get splayed by somebody in your ex's face, Sir Charles is a good choice.
Charles Barkley and James. So this is 93 when all this went down, man. 92,
Also,
93. So I.
she chose James.
Well,
She
he was
chose,
still playing.
yeah, she chose two players, but even though James was still playing, she chose two players that were from such different generations that she probably could have hurt both you and your dad's feelings.
So that's what she did, man. It was so that was infuriating. And then so I got into a fight, and the guy clocked me pretty good in the eye. And I didn't go to the doctor, of course. It turns out he partially detached the retina.
Oof.
But anyway, so the left one went to zero vision gradually. So I've been blind at left eye probably, since about 96. And then the right eye, I had a surgery which led me to Right Blind Ambition in 2009. I was afraid that if I went to total vision loss, that I would commit suicide because I saw my stepdad pass away, and he looked so peaceful, and I thought maybe there's rest at the end of all this fighting. So I thought if I have to rely on people for the rest of my life, I'd rather just not live anymore. So I put all that pressure on myself. And then the surgery became successful, and I wrote that piece of material, and it led to, a career uptick. And then now, 10 years later, it was last June. I was at my crib in Vancouver, and I saw a text, barely could see it, and I closed my eyes, went to sleep the next morning. It was all gone, and so. During the pandemic, I went to zero vision, and so I've just been adjusting ever since.
Can I
So that's it.
what was that that moment where, like you said, you had it and you can remember seeing the text before you went to bed and you woke up and it was gone, having feared it for that long, what was that moment like when you realized it was gone?
I was preparing for it because about a year and a half earlier, I became allergic to the glaucoma meds that they put me on.
Okay.
And so there was no alternatives. And so I had my live-in room and assistant move out because I wanted to learn how to do everything by myself. So I took a blind cooking class and I just want to learn how to do it. If I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it.
Right.
So at first, when
Wow.
I woke up, there was a slight panic, but then I started, just breathe. Just breathe. You're still who you are. You still have the same dreams, and you just have to learn how to do this even better. You're prepared for this. And so there was no more fear after that. It's just more frustration from time to time, but no fear at all. No sadness. It's just, this is just a new part of who I am now.
Wow.
Yeah, that's incredible. Because I'm trying to put myself in your shoes, and I'm not doing well. Like I am not passing the Daryl Lennox test even a little bit. I mean, I've purposely gone to jail because I only had a duffel bag. And thinking about waking up with no vision, you're talking about breathing. My chest is tightening up. Just thinking about it. And I know people, listen, I know there are a lot of people that deal with it, but I'm just thinking about that one morning. And then so how long did you lay in bed that morning? What were you, I mean, you kind of said what you were thinking about, like you're the same person, you have the same dreams, you just have to do it differently. But did you lay in bed all morning trying to make
No,
heads and tails of it?
man, no. Because I played pretty competitive basketball. I knew the first thing you feel something, if you define it in that moment as either good or bad, then that's going to dictate your emotions about it forever.
Yeah.
And so I just wasn't going to lay in that bed and think about not seeing forever. I said, I have to get up. I'm going to meditate, and I've got the house memorized. So just get to work, get to
Sure.
work.
You mentioned
And
you played
so,
competitive basketball. Apparently not competitive enough for your ex-wife. Come on.
all right, okay, which is why she slung those arrows at me. But good insight, Chad. I could see why you went to jail on purpose.
Oh,
So
man.
yeah.
You said something on stage in Madison, and do you mind if I bring it up?
Not at all.
Okay, because I don't know, but you said something that was so interesting to me. You said, with everything that's going on in the world right now, with the pandemic, with political division, you said you have no choice but to trust other people. And that puts you in a whole different headspace. And I thought that was incredible. Like, I actually tuned out for a second. I like tilted my head like a little puppy trying to figure something out. And I was blown away by that. I thought that was incredible.
Fact that I have to trust people, or the fact that I said
The fact that you no, I believe you'll say anything because you can make anything funny, but I'm saying that just the fact that you the whole situation, right? You're saying, well, I can't see anything, so I'm forced to trust other human beings, where people with sight walk around all day judging and not trusting.
yeah, that's this isn't a curse to not be able to see anymore. It's I have to treat it as a gift. And so I was probably one of the least trustful people in the world, because I probably was one of the people who should be trusted the least too. So now, there's nothing but vulnerability when you can't see. Every person that comes up to you could either be a serial killer or your next soulmate. You just don't know. And so you have to engage in order to find out what that person is. And then that person will kind of let you know who they are and what they are, and you make your definitions based upon that. And so I'm never going to see anybody coming at me, and I don't know any agendas. So I have to assume that they are coming to me to help better my journey, or have me help better their journey. So I have to trust the whole process. have to trust every aspect of every process, because I don't know what mistrust looks like anymore. So what else can I do but trust it? I'd have panic attacks if I had to be fearful or mistrustful of anything. I wouldn't know. Let's put it like this. I would get devoured if I was on snakes on a plane. Right? I'd be the first one. I just have to trust every single situation. I have to trust the cab driver knows where he's going. I have to trust that, you know, I'm with who they say they are. So to not trust that would do me a lot of damage, because sure, my imagination would get carried away and it just wouldn't be worth it.
That's fascinating. That's something I wish I could. I mean, since I've stopped lying, I've started trusting a lot more, because I was in the situation you were, where it was like, well, I'm lying, everyone must be lying. But now that I'm not lying, I feel like there's a lot more, you know, there are better people in the world that aren't constantly trying to fuck you over.
Yeah. And you're not one of them either. You know, that's
right.
That's not what I, you know, I did a show to raise some funds for guide dogs. And then there was a lady, I still had a little vision. This lady came up to me and she was blind. And of course, I'm breaking all the rules. I'm rubbing the dog behind his ear and trying to give it part of my hot dog. You're not supposed to touch those damn dogs, but I'm fucking with the dog. and so I said, so what was it like? Show me how you might feel, Cyrus. I said, what's it like? And she goes, yeah, it was a relief. It was a relief. I said, why? And she goes, because I got to stop fighting, not seeing. Now I can just live my life. And now I understand that completely. I'd get to the airport hours and just walk through the wrong gate because I was too stubborn to try to ask for help. But now I just go get some help and I'm there. So I can focus on living my life and being a better person when I'm not, you know, pretending like I can see when I can't and fighting it. It's just another space that I can operate in now.
And do you think, because it was gradual, I think when some people think about a change like that, their life is one way one day and a completely different way the next day. And I would think about, as silly as this sounds, I would think about things like hobbies and the, you know, and we are experiencing incredibly different things. I deal with an autoimmune disease that's stiffened my body and caused chronic pain in a way where I don't interact and enjoy hobbies in the same way. Is there like, how have you, was there like a transition period where you learned how to love the things you used to love in a different way, or you found new ways to enjoy hobbies? And like, what was that like in the transition between sight and no sight?
That was a harder one, because yeah, I could do everything by myself. You know, I used to write, you know, I miss pen to paper.
Yeah.
I always feel like that was my go-to, was to be able to pen to paper, but I can't do that anymore. Yeah. And so that transition was hard. So I would get a notebook, even though I couldn't see anything on it. Now it is write. And of course, you know, nobody could crack that code because I'm writing on top of letters and it's just slanted and crooked.
Sure.
But it helped me feel a little bit better. But then after a while, so, you know, you're hanging on to a past. So if you're going to go, you got to go to a different way. And I can't go for walks and tap into my subconscious mind. So I just different parts of my brain. Instead of watching sports, I listen to them on the radio, which is way more gratifying than watching, because the announcers are better.
I agree.
I can still play chess. And so my assistant got me a blind chess board, which was phenomenal. And I can memorize probably about up to 30 moves in my head. I can play, just me and you could play chess, and you can get the board in front of you, and I can just have all those coordinates in my head and play.
Cool.
But the part of the hobbies that I do miss, you know, that's hard. That's hard. But I got to let go of the past and see what you're going to create in the future, man.
Do you find that playing chess on a board like that, where you have to memorize 30 moves ahead, has made your brain sharper in the comic world?
Yep.
Yeah, yep. I would definitely think that. I mean, there was something I saw you do once, Daryl, and this is before you had lost your vision completely, where you were on stage the first show. So I saw you two shows. and you were on stage the first show, and you were talking to a couple, and you were bringing up things that you knew about them, that it didn't make sense that you knew them. And so afterwards, I asked you, I'm like, did you know that couple? How did you know that stuff? And then you told me you went down and you sat kind of where the people would come in, and you would listen to conversations as they walked in.
Yep.
So you would know stuff about the crowd members. And that was like above and beyond. I mean, I think to me, listening to my set from the night before and taking notes is so painstaking. You know, I like, you know, throw my arms in the air like a child that doesn't get what he wants. And then when you told me you were doing that just to get a little insight from the audience, I mean, it's just another incredible thing that I would have never thought of.
It's everything's about a connection, right? So those people pay their money to come in. And so I always get the earliest because I don't want to hear them filing in. Because even when I could see that, I was never a great crowd work guy because I couldn't make eye contact with them, all sorts of stuff. But I could listen to them with what they're excited about, what they're celebrating. And a lot of time MCs don't ask questions. And so I just listen. But so when I do get on stage, you know, I'm a big dude. And so, you know, everybody deals with their first impressions when they see somebody. But I wanted them to know that I've been paying attention to you. And so that's when I started learning how to do that. You make a good connection with them instead of letting them make the connection with you based upon how you look or the first words out of your mouth. So that's how I learned how to do that.
Yeah, that was amazing. I mean, I was really blown away by it. And if there's any, you know, younger comedians listening to this, I mean, that is absolutely something you should consider, the connection with the audience. Because a lot of guys, you know, they get up there. So, you know, some people are shock comedians where they, you know, they'll get up and they just want the reaction from the crowd. And you know, I play a little bit of that in my, I kind of write some jokes where I get the crowd to groan at it. And then I react to their groans for a punchline. But there are some people that go up and they wonder why the crowd isn't with them when they have these funny jokes. And it's, well, you have to be likable first. There is a first impression, and you have to get the crowd with you and make that connection before you can pull off the jokes that, you know, get people to make that reaction.
Absolutely.
I'm just thinking of myself sitting by the entry to a club and listening to everybody walk by, and you could have 700 people pass me saying the most interesting things you've ever heard, and I'd just be sitting there being like, did you hear that asshole talking about his truck? Like, I would focus in on the right, least interesting, worst person, and I'd be like, where's Jeff? Jeff, let's talk about your truck. And it would just be garbage. You have to isolate me. I'm like a dog with a disease before a show. Just put me in a room and put a cone on my head.
I think you'd be surprised how much people would enjoy that. Because you made Jeff feel listened to. You made Jeff feel listened to and heard, and everybody's going to wonder if you listen to them as well. But you'd be surprised how
I'm worried about what happens if Jeff feels heard.
All right,
Daryl, you so you sat me down in Madison. I mean, not sat me down, like, you know. Listen, we were sitting down together, and you brought something up about, you know, how I do write my jokes sometimes at the beginning to get a groan so then I can yell at the audience for a punchline, whatever. And do you remember what you were telling me?
Yeah, I remember.
Oh, well, I'd like to hear it.
Yeah, you can tell it, because if we have any younger comedians listening, I mean, I think that their ear is probably bleeding from how hard they're pushing their AirPod in.
I've always loved the game, your game, and I used to listen to you on Pandora all the time, and the connection we had in Milwaukee, everybody, you know, so I got to really check you out. But I noticed that you have this incredible ability to get to your premises, and then you will say something, like I said, just to get the reaction so you can react to the action. And I thought, well, why don't you skip that and start with your first initial thought about everything first and allow them to react the way they want to react. So now you're leading them somewhere as opposed to manipulating a reaction so you can get a thing. I mean, I've heard that you're very good looking, but if you have all those other intangibles, you should be leading them down a path as opposed to hiring them as a Sherpa and then shitting on them to get you motivated to keep pushing.
Yeah, I suppose that's right. And I don't, you know, you've only heard that I've changed my voice a bunch of times to tell you I'm good looking. So it's just been me telling you that.
Oh, and, is that what it is? Okay.
And as someone who has often been manipulated by Chad, I couldn't agree more. I think it's time for him to just start treating us straightforward.
Well, it is true because, you know, if somebody can sniff out the manipulation, then all of a sudden they sit there and they're wondering why it's happening and instead of leading. But I thought that was, your comedic insight is absolutely incredible. How do you write? You said that you don't write in notebooks anymore because that was you were holding on to the past. So how do you do it now?
What I just have to listen to things. And so now when people are talking to me about something, whether it be the pandemic or the plandemic, the mask, to this, to that, I'll listen to it and I'll gauge by their emotions. If it registers with me on an emotional level, I'll go, oh, I'm supposed to feel that. Let me dig in and see what it is. But if something is really profoundly affecting somebody, I could be having dinner with somebody. I hear somebody having a deep relationship conversation. I'll see if I can find, whoa, what is she trying to say that he's not hearing? And then I'll pull that out and see if I can find a place to make it said out loud. So my ultimate goal, as an artist, I mean, as a comedian, is to, when they leave, I want them to have experience at some form all five of the emotions. I mean, that's what humanity is. And I try to be very human on stage. So I'm getting all my insights and information from just listening to people talk. Not intentionally. I don't sit down and go, okay, now why don't you say something so I can try to figure out what you're talking about. I just turn my radar on, just listen. And pay attention. And so I avoid, you know, any of the news or any of that sort of stuff, because that's the ultimate manipulation, whereas people are just reacting to the sources around them.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to be the weather vane for all that sort of stuff. And so I just remember it, what they say, and I remember it. And hopefully something pops up out of it.
Wow. That's incredible. I mean, there are times where, and I know I keep going back to my stand-up, but there are times where, you know, I'll be in a show, it's not going great, and instead of doing any of the things you just said, I'm just like, I'm going to try to get the most laughs I can, make people happy, get out. So there's, you know, there's sometimes I'll lose the connection, or I won't consider it fully. And that's great. I think you should write a book on stand-up comedy. Have you ever considered that?
Not in terms of technical applications of it, but I mean, I do want to, you know, do more expressing myself, whether it be through books or whatever. But Kevin had me help teach his class, and I've had other people, you know, talk classes at universities and stuff. But it never crossed my mind to write a book. I certainly read a lot of them growing up.
Sure.
That's funny. There's that big difference between what you, because our audience knows Kevin. He's Kevin Bozeman. He's hosted this show. We obviously love him. He teaches a class on stand-up. You've helped with it. There's such a difference between, there are things like that throughout the country. There's a few people who do it, and it's actually genuinely helpful, and it doesn't cost a bunch of money. And then there are the Kyle Ceases of the world. There's like a few of those shysters out there, like, for $1,800, I'm going to bring in, who the fuck did he bring in? What was it? It was
Louis Anderson.
Louis Anderson,
Louis,
yeah.
Anderson.
I'm going to bring in, yeah, Louis Anderson, and we're going to teach you how to do comedy in the 80s. Here, give us your money, everybody. So, like, that's an interesting thing, because I think people like Cease give other people the idea that you can't teach stand-up comedy. But I think anybody who's become a good comic knows that you can. You just generally learn it from the headliner who takes you on the road, or the people who are kind enough to share, you know, their thoughts on your work and how to get better and how to be a pro. But I think that's really interesting when people can actually teach it like Kevin does and like you were able to be a part of that.
Yeah, he teaches at DePaul University. He has a class which is just outrageous. And the final is they go on stage and perform. And you know, I've been doing like 23 years I've been doing this, and I'm still learning from people like Kevin and Daryl and many others. But
Sigh, and yeah.
what were you Oh, I love it. Kyle Cease, of course.
Kyle.
Hey, Daryl, do you want to tell us about your new album coming up? So you have a new album, Super Bloom,
Right.
and it is out because this will come out Monday. And so your album is out. It is available to listen. It is available to buy. You want to tell us about the process there?
Yeah, it was I started working on it in 2000, early 2018 or 19, when the California fires had went and burnt it all up, and then there's torrential downpour, and then which of those two devastation, natural disasters weren't enough, what else is? And because of those two natural disasters, nature took over, and there was a burst of poppies, just incredible, that helped resurrect that community. So that struck a chord with me. I never saw the actual poppies or anything, but it struck a chord with me to just, trust the process, trust the universe. It jives with my belief system. I was going through it because my Jill, my first wife, Charles Barkley, she had really, we knew each other for 4 months, and the marriage lasted for 4 months, and she had such a big impact on me to prove to her that I wasn't, what she thought I was. I actually recorded Blind Ambition on October 2nd, our anniversary date, because to thank her. But we stayed friends after I made amends with her. We became friends, but she just went through a lot of hard things in life, and so a couple years ago, she called me and said she just didn't want to live like this anymore. It's too much pain, and she was felt disconnected from her kids, and so I tried to talk her out of it, but she killed herself. And so I felt so hurt that I'd gotten so much from her, and given so little back. And that she got to see me on Conan and listen to the other podcasts that I was on and everything. She's so proud of me, but I couldn't stop her from, I couldn't help her in that pain. I was remarried, and there was I couldn't do enough. And so when she did it, and I found out she did it, it just devastated me. And then at that same time, my dad, who has a huge impact on me as well, had finally he got cancer and just wasn't going to fight it. So I'm preparing for that. So I was like, well, where's my super bloom at? So I knew I had to try a way to talk about that. And so that became the beginnings of the album. And then fast forward to the going blind and the pandemic and the George Floyd. And there was so much world going on, and so much angst and pain from everybody feeling it. And all I could be was introspective, breathe and meditate and go, how am I going to show up in this thing? And I love Chappelle's skill set, but he was setting the war, setting those guys, setting people on fire. And he first thinks you try to do something like something, but then I was like, but that's just not me. That is just not who I am. So I have to try to find a way to make all this intense divisiveness and hurt and pain and turn it into a positive like I've done for my life. So that's what the album is, and I'm pretty proud of it, man. It's really something. It's not something like I've ever done before, and I don't think, a lot of people could have did it because it's been incredible hard work, but I'm really, really proud of it.
Yeah, I'm very excited. So we're recording this the week of the release. It's not out yet while we're recording, but it is out while people are listening. I can't wait
Right.
because I was listening to a band once called Radio On. They're from my hometown, and it's the old, I was sitting in the back of the venue, And they started playing their opening song. It was a cover of "Hello There, Ladies and Gentlemen." And by the time the song was over, I found myself in the crowd. Without knowing it, I had stood up and walked forward because I was so entranced. When you did the bit about Super Bloom, I was sitting when you started. I was out of my seat. I was walking forward and I felt absolutely mesmerized. And then when you hit the punchline, my hands went to my knees like I had just run 15 miles and I was out of breath from laughing. God damn it. I mean, I felt tricked, but also like I was given a king's bounty. It was incredible.
Thank you, man. It means a lot, man. It really means a lot to be getting reviews from peers. You know, that's when you know, because we all know the tricks.
Yeah.
But
sure.
You know, and all comedy really is a big game of peekaboo. You know, that's where everybody's sense of humor starts from. It's peekaboo, and so the better you are at getting to the peekaboo and still getting a laugh, the better you are at the game, and so. That's what I try to do. And I'm glad you felt it, man.
Oh, I sure did. I mean, we have a mutual friend, Duke from Milwaukee, that came with you to the shows, and it was great to see him. But he was laughing really hard at me because of how I was laughing. I mean, it was like this just wildfire had broken out, and then when I finally came up for air, you could see, so I was sitting behind the audience and you could see people's shoulders shaking and their hands were going up in the air. I mean, it was like a really visceral reaction from almost everyone. I don't know, man. Well done. Like I said, I can't wait to hear the whole album. And again, you can listen to Daryl's Blind Ambition too. That's because that's...
Yeah, and Chad and I have a very strong rule about not pushing other people's podcasts because we're, you know, rickety bitches. But I got to tell you, man, I don't even really listen to Maron, and I don't have anything against him, but it's just not really, it's never really been my show. I remember years ago you were on WTF, and I just randomly caught a message or an episode after I heard somebody else's. That is one of the best fucking episodes of that. I mean, that was one of the best podcast episodes I'd heard at any point in my life. Obviously, before Mike Cronin came on our show, but it was, not to send people from our show to another show, but your fucking episode of Maron was great, dude.
Like, man, you know, that's, I don't know how to describe it, but that's, you know, that is what all that stuff felt like. So when, you know, I recorded Blind Ambition on me and Jill's anniversary and I finished. And I remember next day, I was just too full of energy. And I remember, you know, I just cried because I knew there was a big release of the path that I've been hanging on to. And then, when everybody started calling with Maron and everything, and so I got to talk to Maron about it. And it was weird too, because I'd already done that work. I'd already done that work and lived that stories and everything. But then I knew that I had to tell that story so that everybody else couldn't.
Right.
Sure.
So it was just a raw and emotional thing. You know, if you tell people, you know, why you're a womanizer, then when the women come out and tell you you're a womanizer, it just lessens everything. And so I wanted this piece of work to really mean something. So I want to tell everybody, you know, I was selfish and an arrogant asshole, and I made a lot of mistakes, but I made amends. And so rather than try to be up there slinging jokes or trying to get, you know, Maron's approval or any of that sort of stuff, I just knew, you know, this is who I am.
Yeah, it was just very... So,
I'm glad it hits you.
Yeah, it was just very, anytime you can tell someone is really raw and vulnerable, maybe because that is the opposite of who I am, I think I admire that greatly. It's like, we also have a mutual friend. Do you know Ryan Singer? I know Chad and I know him quite well.
Ryan Singer, sure. That was the guy, New York guy. He won Boston 1 year, right?
Yeah,
good joke writer. No, that's Ryan Stout.
That's Ryan Stout.
Yeah.
Ryan Singer is.
I know Ryan Singer.
Yep. Really funny dude. Bunch of great stuff. But he got basically sexually catfished by a cam girl and went on and talked about it on Marin. And same thing. It was just like, you are just the I fucking love vulnerability. And I think, you know, with Blind Ambition, that's what I'm looking forward to this, the next special as well, with all the stuff. You and Chad are close. You and I are, you know, we don't have that relationship. But as a fan of yours, man, the vulnerability is great. So this has been really fun to have you be on here.
Glad you guys let me do it, too. And anyway, I can be of assistance to help you guys, I certainly would love to. I really, really appreciate it.
Well, absolutely. And I just want to say, I'm going to recommend if people, so I would listen to Blind Ambition first.
Yes.
And then go to Super Bloom. But for sure, listen to both. For sure, Super Bloom, rate it. You know, give it some comments, because that gets it out into the algorithm or whatever it is. But again, dude, it is such an honor to have you on the show, because you are just probably the smartest guy about comedy that's I've ever talked to, and I am absolutely thrilled that we have become friends.
You, man. We started in Mexico, and now look where we are, huh?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, and if you're ever curious if somebody believes that peekaboo sentence more than you, you let me make a joke about Charles Barkley and James Worthy blasting your ex, and I made a joke about your ex and your dad, and you just held that for an hour to reveal that your new piece of art is heavily influenced by both of those people's deaths. So fucking peekaboo, everybody. Daryl's the king.
There you go.
I gotta go.
All right, man. Thank you guys very much.
Hey, if you guys like this, there will be a new episode next Monday and every single Monday at 8 a.m. So click the subscribe button so your phone sends it to you without having to do any work.